Good evening, everyone. You're listening to Red Pill 78. As always, my name is Zach Payne, the Corruption Detector, and this is another edition of Red Pill News for Saturday Night Live Stream. Joining me in the studio tonight is a first-time guest, a man by the name of Alec Niewald. He is an author, he's a writer, he's a sailor, he's a race car driver, an explorer, and a student of mythology, the paranormal, ancient history, and so much more. Let me ask you guys a question. What do you think it would be like if you set out on an average drive you had made many times in the past, you're expecting a three-hour trip, and then 10 days later, you pull into your driveway, and your entire family's standing there. Where the heck have you been? How do you think that would feel? Well, my guest Alec here, it's actually happened to him, and it goes way deeper than that. He's actually written a book about this experience, and we're going to talk about this. There are some ramifications for his life that I think a lot of people consider nowadays as a very real possibility. So I'm really, really looking forward to speaking with Alec about his experiences and what he's learned and where his life has gone, how it has evolved since that time. So do me a favor, sit back, relax, grab your popcorn. We're going to be right back after this with Alec Newell. Warnings of a recession are growing louder as we near sell in May and go away. Citibank warned the soft landing dream is over. The U.S. economy is headed for a recession in the middle of 2024. Morgan Stanley warns a U.S. dollar regime shift could threaten stocks. And meanwhile, the Fed's most trusted recession indicator is flashing code red, because every recession since 1945 has been preceded by a yield curve inversion. Meanwhile, the M2 money supply is meaningfully contracting for only the fifth time since 1870. All signs appear to point to a sizable downturn for the Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ. Now, meanwhile, gold prices have been hitting all-time highs, and the rally is far from over. Now, y'all know silver is always late to the party, but once it finds momentum, it can easily outperform gold. So protect your retirement with gold or place a bullish bet on silver. Call the proud Americans of the Patriot Gold Group today before it's too late. Just mention Red Pill 78 and this show, Red Pill News, and you're always going to get best-in-class service from Patriots Protecting Patriots. Patriot Gold Group has the no-fee for Life IRA, where your IRA or 401k can be in physical gold and silver, and you just might be eligible for that no fee for life IRA on qualifying rollovers. So give them a call today at 888-857-6092 and get your free investor guide today. Patriot Gold Group is a Consumer Affairs top-rated gold IRA dealer for 7 years in a row. Call them today at 888-857-6092. And when you support my sponsors, you support this channel. All right. Good evening, everyone. Welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us. And please join me in welcoming my guest for this evening, Alec Niewald. Alec, am I pronouncing that right? I realize it might be Niewald, but, you know, it could be tomato, tomato.
Hey, you got a lot closer than most. I'm usually called Hey You or something like that. Don't worry about it too much. Yeah, no, a lot of people actually call me Alex. They think it's an A-L-E-X, but it's an A-L-E-C, so it's just Alec.
Okay, good.
Don't know what that means, but my mother always said, well, we wanted to make a short name so you couldn't be, you know, shortened down to anything more, but everyone calls me Al, so there you go. You can't win.
All right. Well, we're on the right track. That's great. That's great. So, Alec, you are a native of New Zealand. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. Little Pacific nation. I guess you could say south and east of Australia. Most people know where Australia is, of course. Yeah. We're about 1500 miles off the coast of Australia. We consider Australia as just another island that belongs to New Zealand. The Aussies don't see it that way, but they give us a lot of stick and we give it back. So we have a lot of fun. But we are really isolated, as you might imagine.
Oh, yeah.
We're a 12-13 hour flight away from pretty much you guys for a start, and the rest of the world. So, yep, we're a little South Pacific community.
It's a beautiful country. I've always been fascinated by both Australia and New Zealand. New Zealand, I mean, in particular, it's a lot of beautiful country. Australia, it's some beautiful country and then a lot of desert. So you've got just a little bit better off there in New Zealand, it seems like.
Yeah, it's I suppose we could sell it a bit, but you know, it is extremes. We have two islands, two major islands, north and south, we call them.
Okay.
Just to be different.
Sure.
Yeah, and the South Island, I just did a 3-week tour, which is probably why we're having this conversation now and not a little earlier.
That's right.
And it's a, you would think it's a different country. It's an alpine set, basically. Ranges run right down the backbone of the South Island. There's snow, there's ice, there's glaciers, there's beautiful native, unspoilt native forest, rainforests, of course. And the North Island is more, I would say, commercial, but it has a lot of white sand beaches, less mountains, very little snow in the winter. Just a different country, really. So I've always been amazed that you can actually visit two countries when you visit New Zealand.
That's pretty cool. You know, I mean, I kind of get the same feeling a little bit here in the United States just because it's such a large landmass. I mean, you go north, south, east, west, and there are so many different terrains. So I imagine it'd be like that. But you're on islands, and that's just a little bit cooler. So tell me about this. As you grew up, you decided to get into race car driving. Is that correct? You build race cars, you drive them. I mean, how did you come across that as a career?
It's a split format. Basically, from a younger age, I was more interested in sailing and racing yachts. So my sort of life path started off with a professional sporting career, I guess you could say, because I wanted to improve my sailing and racing, yacht racing expertise. My first job was sail making, learning to make the sails for the yachts, because the sails are the engine of a yacht, so you need to know all about that to make the boat go fast. So I've always been competitive, I guess, by nature. But all boys like to play with cars, you know, and you can't wait to get your first car. And as soon as you get it, you want to go as fast as you can. And I think that competitive urge just sprung out of that. Let's do both, I thought. But sailing was my first love. Like at 12, I brought myself a little sailing dinghy. And from there on through high school, all I wanted to do was race yachts and learn as much as I could. I spent all my time in the library reading up about, you know, how to make boats and how to make them go fast. So that's my background. And the racing came later because it's a more expensive sport. Well, they're both expensive, but
right,
certainly motorsports are a big pit to pour money down. So unless you're working in a good job, you don't even attempt it. So although, you know, I raced what I had. I raced my road cars, which was always a bit dangerous because you end up with a broken car and you're walking. So, but from that, of course, expanded. I've always been like curious about everything. So what you read out there on my sort of, you know, basic profile is no stone unturned. Race engineering, I do build, or certainly do a lot of work on my own race cars. I've built my own yachts and built my own sails, of course. So I call one of the yachts I had Solo, because I did everything on it from the scratch, from designing it to building it to racing it. It was a one-man yacht.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, so likewise in motorsport, I've pretty much been a loner in as much as a lot of times you get people to help you, but they don't always do the things the way you want them, or they muck them up and you end up doing them yourself. So
that's,
I thought, well, I might as well just do it for myself.
Yeah.
You know, so from that format, I have been a little bit of a loner, I guess, a hermit as far as sports goes. And likewise, this experience we'll be talking about actually isolates you even more so.
It's I would
most
imagine.
Difficult. Most difficult subject to talk about, because 99% of the population don't know about it or don't want to know about it. And the first thing they think, associate you, you know, conspiracy theorist and a nutter.
Mm-hmm.
So Yep. So it's very difficult. Like, I mean, I really appreciate the show of yours, Zach. And your listeners, I would presume, are really switched on to alternate realities. And that's what we're discussing here.
Exactly.
There's not, it's not just one. We don't just live in one format on this planet. It's wide open. And when you do get curious to search, like my interest in mythology and paranormal, that you just drop down into a pit that opens up and gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And, and as you would know, because you've been investigating this stuff for many years, obviously.
Yes, yes. You know, and I always tell my audience, you know, even if you don't believe the story that my guest is telling you, you know, like, take the concept. What is it we accept just as a given at this point, that we've been lied to, right? That the nature of our reality is not as it's being defined. And so simply based upon that, just stop for a moment and open your mind to the possibilities of what are out there. Because if you haven't seen it, if you haven't experienced it, then how do you know that it's there? How do you know that it's real? I mean, does it even – it's like the idea of a tree falling in the woods with no one around to hear it. Does it make a sound? Well, I don't know. I mean, nobody's there to hear it. However, just because we don't hear it doesn't mean that the sound isn't there. So I am absolutely fascinated by that which we cannot see, by that which we have not directly experienced. You know, as a person of faith, I take for granted what I'm going to experience when I die. But at the end of the day, I really don't know what that's going to be because I haven't been there. I haven't experienced that portion of my life yet, but I have had some very interesting experiences that fall completely outside of what I would consider the norm, that mean human experience here on Earth. And, you know, that is what we're going to be talking about tonight. But it's an incredible story. Alec, let me just say this for the audience, too. Anytime I meet someone who has an incredible story, I do kind of like a mental calculus on the likelihood of the reality of what they experienced. And I do that just because there are so many people who have fantastic stories. Some people are, you know, great writers, okay? So they can come up with things that are fantastic. You know, other people are a little bit less comfortable talking about something that would be a really great story. A lot of people would listen to it. But I tend to find a lot more credence in people who do not define their lives by whatever that one experience is. Because as you said, this is something that it isolates you among the general population. Like most people having not gone through something that's just so fantastical, it's difficult for them to comprehend. It's difficult for them to relate to. And so, you know, you haven't made your life. You've continued to be a race car driver. You've continued to be a student of all of these things, a bit of a polymath, if you will. And you know, and you wrote one book. And now, hopefully, you're going to be writing an update to that book. But I want to go back to that night in 1989. You know, 1989, I was 11 years old. I remember that year specifically because I found a brand new penny outside of my house. And I looked at it and I thought to myself, my God, I'm 11 years old. I can't believe this. I can't believe it's been 11 years that I've been on this earth. And then you, at that time, you were already an adult. You already had a career, and you're living in this beautiful land in New Zealand. And you were driving home. Tell me the story of what happened that night.
Yeah, well, there's a lot goes before that, actually. This was not a nighttime. It was a daytime event. But and I wasn't driving home. I was driving away from home. We had just had a dramatic sort of marriage split. And that's a lot of people said, oh, this is just shock. And this is a typical reaction to somebody that's had a dramatic event in their life concerning, you know, marriage is a big long-term commitment. And I'd been married for 15 years. It wasn't just a, you know, 3 or 4 days or nights. It was a 15-year commitment that had been dissolved, basically, and the idea was that I would drive up to Auckland to stay with a friend for a while. So that's what I was actually doing, leaving the home family environment in a bit of a shocked state, and literally driving that car, I was thinking to myself, what is this all about? If there's something else out there, make contact and tell me what this, the meaning of all this was. And that was literally going through my head. And the other alternative was, well, I'd drive under a big truck or something or off a cliff. You know, your mind is sort of like numbed to a certain degree, but certainly there was a shock factor. And I was in a sort of a state where you just can't quite get all your ducks in a row. So, mm-hmm. And a lot of people said, oh, well, this is the end result of that and write it off. You know, you imagined all this, or you've gone into comatose state or whatever. I mean, and it's very easy even for me to believe that that could be so, because I doubted this more than anyone could possibly doubt, because nothing like this had actually happened to me before either.
I would bet.
Yeah. But of course, but you can't write that off, because there's a whole gambit of events that followed on, taking the last 30 years of my life, sucked it into a whirlpool, if you like. And you just cannot write off a 3-hour drive as a comatose state, and you'd lost your mind, and whatever happened and in your imagination. So
right.
I was willing to believe in that initially, but of course what happened when I woke up and moving on from that proved that was actually the events that I remember are more real than just having a marriage breakdown and a mental breakdown.
That's the thing when external forces enter your life after an experience like this and reinforce that as the reality. I mean, it must have, I would imagine it would have completely just split your noggin. You know, I mean, like, it's one thing to experience something that is unexplainable. Your friends, your family, they say, Alec, come on, you and your wife, this is rough. You know, I mean, I personally, Alec, I've been through a divorce. I've known a lot of people who have been through divorces. They've never experienced anything like you. And I can picture your friends and family and the mental gymnastics that they must have gone through to try to get you to believe that that was really all it was. I mean, that must have been difficult for them. And I'm certain that what you experienced afterwards, that must have also had an impact on them as well. I don't want to jump too far ahead of ourselves, though. I do want to know about that later on. But let's go ahead and go back to your driving. You're very upset. You're thinking to yourself, maybe I should just end it, or maybe something else is out there for me, something more.
Yeah, I was going to just loop back to the childhood stuff, because you know I had some pretty unusual dreams. So I had been alerted to a realities outside of our own, you know, and even as a young boy. So this drive home, a lot of people have even said that, well, maybe the marriage breakup was orchestrated by forces outside of your reality that you don't understand. Because this was a time that was required for some splicing of a larger story here being formed. You know, I don't disagree or agree with that. It just seems that there is a possibility that the timing is so precise that mm-hmm. it almost needed to happen, because there appeared to be a job for me to do following on from this experience, and maybe there was no more time left. The entities that I met up with during this experience actually said, we've spliced into your time now, what they call our now time, because this is the last opportunity within reason that we would have to get real human beings into what they needed as a gene pool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, that doesn't make any sense back in 1989, but it certainly makes sense after 2022 mm-hmm. and COVID and these weird sort of injections that the ruling masters insisted that everybody on this planet must take. I mean,
right.
That's never happened in the history of mankind before, that we've been that healthy people have been forced to take a medication, which is really, if you examine it, open with an open mind, a high-tech piece of well, it's called a bioweapon. I wouldn't, I'm not sure about that, but most certainly it's a piece of technology that needs to be in, that they wanted to insert into people.
That a genetic modification vector, maybe.
Exactly. So therefore, so these entities, I interacted with them. I said, this is the last opportunity to grab real humans. Is this what they meant? Because I couldn't foresee 30 years into the future.
Right.
But it makes sense now.
Certainly, certainly. All right. So you said that you had had some interesting dreams, some experiences when you were a child. What about when you were actually on the road? I mean, what was the last thing that you remembered before you blacked out? Because from what I understand, you didn't have a full memory of what had transpired until after you arrived at your final destination.
Yep. Something happened during that 3-hour drive, obviously, but I did have vague memories of the car misbehaving. It felt like I was almost paralyzed while I was driving it. Like it felt like there was a weight came down on me. And then the memories I had is that I couldn't move the steering wheel and I couldn't move my feet. So I couldn't apply the brakes or take my foot off the accelerator. Mm-hmm. And this was a fairly windy, twisty road, with some rock outcrops and that. And I don't drive slow for reasons that you
can imagine.
Explained before. Yeah. So, and I had a reasonably powerful car and I wasn't in a mood that made me want to be safe. If you know what I mean, I didn't really care. So I was hoofing it and then I had this vague feeling that shit, there's a rock face coming up and I'm going to hit it and this is going to hurt. And I sort of almost felt myself say, ouch, this is going to hurt. And of course, then that blanks out and I continued on the drive as far as my memory goes at that moment. So I sort of wiped that out of my mind. That couldn't have happened. That was just a blip, you know. And I continued on as if that 3-hour drive was seamless. Mm-hmm. And I arrived at my friend's destination. You realize and you're all out of context. There's no days of the week. Mm-hmm. There's no hours of the day. You just had a dramatic marriage breakup. You're not going to your job. Mm-hmm. I've been employed, self-employed most of my life. So I never have had a boss to report to, if you like. Anyway, right. When you run your own business, if you're a sole occupant of that business, you don't turn up for work. Nobody gives a shit, you know.
Right.
So nobody's sort of say, oh, where are you? And I have been running for the last 20 years an internet business where my shop front was my website. So mm-hmm. I didn't have to even report to. I just clicked on my emails and it's my customers' requests.
Yep. And no cell phones. No cell phones to speak of in 1989.
Yeah. No cell phones in 1989. Not even at that point in time, actually, not even really an internet you could speak of.
Right.
It was
right.
Very rudimentary. But beside that point, I mean, I just got to the to my friend's house and I was going, I think I'd rung him beforehand, said, look, I'm coming up. I didn't even explain to him what had really happened with the marriage. I thought I'll sort all that out when I get there. Mm-hmm. We'll just, you know, catch up with him. I'll stay with him for a few days, get myself sorted out, make my plans for whatever that might be. So I didn't even take much notice of what day of the week it was, and I certainly didn't take a lot of notice of what the date was. Mm-hmm. This has a repercussion later on because I think it was, I don't know, a Tuesday or a Wednesday or something like that. Anyway, the kids were on holiday what would have been my Thursday, what should have been a Thursday, and I just thought, oh, is it a school holiday? Is it a midterm break or something? He said, no, it's Saturday. And that tripped me up a bit because, well, hang on, I left home on, say, Tuesday. I've been here for 2 days and now it's Saturday. And even that didn't compute at all. But later on, I found out it was a Saturday the week after, actually. Mm. So you've got those 3 or 4 days of the week, initially and then another week again, which made 10 days anyway from when I left home. to the actual day that I, you know, would have arrived there. So, when I figured out there was 10 days missing. So, but even then, that's when everyone said, oh, you've just had some sort of a mental blackout. You know, you obviously, well, the thing was, they said, well, you must have slept in the car. But no one can sleep in a car for 10 days on the side of the road without sort of not realizing it or someone tapping on your window.
Exactly.
I didn't have enough money. And I had it like about $100 cash on me, and that was for petrol and stuff. I don't even recall if I had a credit card at that stage. I mean, anyway, no money was executed from my bank account, and I still had the majority of the $100. So I hadn't stayed in a motel or hotel. I couldn't have eaten. I didn't even have a bed, you know, like, you know, 10 days away,
yeah.
you'd notice it, you know.
Absolutely.
And not changing your clothes, possibly, stuff like that. I mean,
that's been noticeable too. Yeah. Yeah.
You would think so. Yeah. But I got up there as fresh as if I'd just
the morning
driven for 3 hours. Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff going on in your head that didn't make sense, but because there's no answer to it, you just sort of, you have to brush it aside. I mean, I still had to live.
Right.
I had to sort my finances out. I had to sort my life out. And I'm staying at a friend's place. Couldn't stay there forever. So, So
what was his response? I mean, was he expecting you to get there in 3 hours, or, I mean, was he just like, mate, I get it. You know, it's been 10 days. You do you.
No. Well, this is it, you see. I just said to him, look, I when I'd rung him, I said, look, I'm coming up to stay a few days. I didn't even tell him when.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, so he didn't actually expect me at any particular time. The fact that I turned up 10 days later, okay, so you're a little bit later than I thought. Mm-hmm. But he didn't know if I was going to stop somewhere on the way with other friends, whatever. So, and as I said, I didn't tell him it was a marriage breakup, so he wouldn't have worried too much about it. I didn't want to worry anyone about it. It's my own personal business. It was only later on in discussions that we decided that, hey, hang on, you know, we've got 10 days missing here.
Yeah.
And he didn't know what to make of that any more than I did.
Now, what about your soon-to-be ex-wife and your children? I mean, were they at all concerned, or did she, you know, just want – she didn't care. She just didn't – she wanted you out of the house.
No. Well, I didn't say, I'll be in touch, you know. Like this is, you walk out of the house and you say, well, that's the end of that, you know.
I get it.
and even if it had only been an all-3-hour drive, would I have rung her within a week? Possibly not, you know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have been quickly on the phone to – and certainly – if I'd figured out I had some missing time, that's the last person I was going to ring and discuss it with, quite honestly. I mean, I was not angry, but a little bit disappointed in everything that had happened. So,
sure.
No, she wasn't going to be my first port of call. So that's where we discussed it with friends, basically.
Okay, got it. And I'm assuming that, you know, obviously nobody saw you in that 10 days. I mean, like, I don't know much about the 3 hours in between point A to point B. But, I mean, it seems like it was kind of remote. I mean, like, if you had been seen, people would have remembered you, I would think.
Well, what was to be seen? You know, for all I know, actually, I might have been parked away somewhere in the bush somewhere. Like, you know, who knows? I mean, no one does that deliberately. But there was just so many permutations of connotations of what might have happened. And none of them made sense because of the fact that I was fresh and shaven and no money had been spent.
Yes.
And of course, the end, actually, what did start to happen is the car started to act up rather strangely after that, which going back and researching it, that the car had been involved in this 10 days away.
Mm-hmm.
And when it was reassembled, if you like, along with me, it didn't get put together quite as well as I was. So
what was wrong with it?
Everything, basically. the first thing that started happening, like all the rubber seals that you have in the hydraulics, like the brakes and power steering, the rubber seals seemed to dissolve. And of course, that produced a leakage on your braking and your power steering.
Yes.
And so I spent quite a bit of time replacing all those. And then the engine management system is a very early computer format Jaguar car, which had quite a sophisticated engine management system for its time.
Oh, yes.
Early 80s. And there seemed it had a little rheostat which measured fuel and airflow running into the engine. And I didn't know it at the time, but that whole assembly was a reversed or a mirror image of what it should have been. So it was running rich when it should have been running lean. And so I fiddled with it, got it to run a little better, but it was never perfect. And that's in the long term. I sold that car because of all the problems I was having with it. And whoever inherited it from me obviously had similar problems, took it to maybe a Jaguar dealer in Auckland here, and somebody pulled it apart or found that this engine management system was certainly malfunctioning in a way they couldn't fix either.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they sent the part back to Jaguar England for diagnostic purposes, or they certainly would have had to replace it. And then maybe at a later date they sent it, look, how does this get in this car?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I had a knock on the door from people, local people in Auckland calling themselves from the DSIR, which is Department of Scientific and Industrial Research here in Auckland, or was in 1989. And I had a guy with a strong English British accent asking me a lot of questions about this car. And in that process of questioning, he showed me a picture. He said, here's your engine management system. He said, this is a mirror image of what the factory would have produced for that car. And he said, can you explain how that got into the car? Well, of course, I couldn't.
No.
And he also said, there seems to be some signs of a high voltage surge running through the car. And I don't know how they diagnose that, but they've got obviously got gauges and machinery that can do that. If a metal component had been highly charged at some stage, mm-hmm. it must give out a reading. I don't know. But anyway, so all of this was coming from someone that I'd never met before and was trying to almost intrude into my whole life gambit at that stage. And I sort of resisted that. I'm, as I said, a bit of a loner. I don't take the strangers knocking on my door and wanting to know all about my life and where has the car been the last 10 days or 30 days, up to a month or so later.
Well,
you know,
Alec, you know, yeah. the I used to have a 1986 Jaguar XJ6. And the joke is, if you're a Jaguar owner, you've got to have two because one of them is always going to be in the shop.
Yeah, well, it was an XJ6, actually. It was an 82 model, I think. So, you know.
Beautiful cars, but they just.
Yes. But funnily enough, that car for me had run like a dream,
sure.
Run
well,
like a top.
As a mechanic, yeah. I'm sure that you were right on top of it, you know. But
Yeah, but this was something certainly
totally
like,
different.
I mean, I'd never had rubber seals melt, you know, like.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff that was going wrong with that car that I was continually trying to fix. And it was just such a headache. Yeah, I'm getting rid of this.
So, I would imagine. So tell me about the DSIR. Is that an official branch within like the New Zealand federal government, or did they work for like the province or the state that you lived in? I mean, who did they work for?
Yeah, that would be a government. The DSIR now no longer exists as an entity. They've changed their name, but as it stands for the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research, they are a government-backed company, I guess, that tries to find interesting projects that could help industry or science advancements in New Zealand, or for people in general.
Sure.
You know, better ways to generate power or whatever. So they're very high-techy, would have been very high-tech for their time and age. They would have been overweight with a lot of stuff at the high end of technology. And henceforth, it wasn't such a surprise that someone like that would knock on my door.
Sounds-
because this car had some strange technology basically induced into it, I guess.
Right,
so,
right.
I mean, but in actual fact, when this guy showed me his credentials at the door, there was another set of credentials, which was what I could see was a Royal Crest or something, and it had an RIIA. I didn't know, have a clue what RIIA stood for until I was talking to some friends much, much later. And this was the Royal Institute of International Affairs. And as this guy had a strong British accent, I would assume that his DSIR credentials were just given to him as a format to introduce to me as a Kiwi.
Sure.
I would accept him as a local sort of scientist rather than someone that's come all the way from Great Britain to question me about my car.
So,
but in actual fact, that's what I assume was happening.
So RIAA, that's Chatham House, isn't it?
That is Chatham House. Yes,
yeah.
Well, that's what it is. See, that also underwent a name change from 1989 to the 1990s, like the DSIR. I don't even know what it's called now, but something similar but different. And Chatham House is now, yeah. And
okay.
these are think tank. These are, once again, leading edge technical experts, and they're think tanks for the whole human gambit. These are not guys to be dismissed. If you've got them inquiring about your experience, there's something really serious going on that they want to know about. So,
yes.
And I only found out a lot of this stuff like months and years later, who these people really were. So because I started to talk to people in the UFO community, once I realized that the 10 days away was not a comatose state on the side of the road, but actually an ET interaction, then, of course, the first thing I wanted to do was, well, are there other people that have had these experiences?
Of course.
Who else can help explain this to me? So I went searching locally in Auckland for UFO groups, of course, because I'm a curious guy, and I was like, well, come on, somebody else must have had a similar experience.
Now, did you happen to ask the gentleman from the DSIR, did you put two and two together at any point that, you know, maybe the missing time had something to do with the strange parts that were on the Jaguar? Or did you ask them if they were aware of what had happened to you?
They weren't interested in answering questions.
Oh, okay.
They were only asking them.
We're here to ask questions, not answer them.
Yeah, exactly. They weren't here to answer anything. And that annoyed me, actually.
I bet.
First of all, the intrusion on they wanted to come in. I never let them pass the doorstep. But they were trying to force themselves onto me. And in a way, once you get inside someone's house, then you sort of like can take over.
Absolutely.
The situation. I wanted them to be a door-to-door salesman. They can stay on that doorstep, and they're not coming. I'm not buying this simply because I'm, once again, of my private sort of way of life. I've never been, if you like, a fan of government departments anyway.
Bureaucracy. You and me both.
Government bureaucracy and me are not best friends. So
the fewer the better.
And here we had it with spades on. You know, these guys were the cream of that. I could tell they were used to giving instructions and not taking them. So
certainly.
They weren't answering any questions, but they certainly wanted, I mean, the whole attitude, I wanted to kick them off the doorstep after 5 minutes. So,
I take it they were not friendly. I mean, they were assertive.
Aggressive.
Yes, aggressive.
Aggressive would be the best way to describe it. And but strange with it. Like, you know, you've probably come across an explanations of the Men in Black and all this sort of thing.
That's the first thing I was thinking about. Yeah.
Well, these weren't dressed in black and didn't have bowler hats or whatever the case may be, but they were, I mean, they were strangers to me. This guy was obviously very British, very, very confident, and very forthright, very, a tough cookie. You know, he would be what you would call an agent, you know, an alphabet agent, basically.
Sure.
You know, CIA would be the equivalent, American equivalent, RIA or whatever it was, or the MI6 from England. Mm-hmm. These guys are directly connected, the Royal Institute and the MI6.
Yes.
Hand in hand. So you could work for both, I would imagine. And I got that distinct impression that these guys didn't take no for an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I pushed them out, I think, really rubbed them the wrong way. And that probably made the end result of this worse than it maybe should have been.
Right.
But I wasn't going to cooperate. I didn't totally know what was going on, but I had I had an idea in the back of my mind what was going on about the alien intervention. And I was working my way through that to understand it. And I knew almost instinctively that alphabet agencies and people that are having alien experiences don't go down so well, you know, you lose control of your own life if you allow it. So yeah, I was resistant, you could say.
So after you made it clear to them that you weren't interested in answering any questions and let them know that really you didn't have any answers, you begin going around and looking to see if you can find people who have had any similar. Did you find anyone in your area that had had similar experiences or that had any sort of answers that might lead you to the knowledge of what happened?
Well, that's the strangest thing, because one of the biggest UFO groups I attached myself to had the most members anyway, so therefore the widest group of experiences you could have. They were hostile about their experiences. They had some very bad experiences, and they were – they. How could I describe it? They were anti-alien interventions. They were saying, look, this happened, that happened. And years and years of experience since researching deeper and deeper, I think they have had what you could call human-induced alien experiences.
Yeah.
And for all sorts of reasons, to give aliens a bad name, apart from anything else, and to make people fearful of having alien experiences. And mine was I had no resentment. I mean, I consider that I hooked up with some friends. They were family, as they described it, and I brought into that. I mean, I believed that to be true. So I'd had a wonderful experience, an enlightening experience, and most of the people that I connected with those UFO groups were just the opposite. They were hostile about them. So I didn't find my way with those groups. If you know, I didn't learn a lot about my own experience, which in the end set me off of, once again, a personal private course of investigating it and the whole UFO gambit and the ET gambit, personally and privately, because I couldn't rely on other people's experiences to reflect or learn about mine.
So those people that you met in that group, did they have like a sort of uniformity of negative experiences, or was it just a bunch of different types of bad experiences? Because, you know, I mean, like, let's just assume that, you know, alien life is out there. I mean, with as large as the universe is, I would have to imagine that there are different species of aliens or different groups, you know, so perhaps different groups with different end games and even personality profiles, maybe.
Well, yeah. That's it. This is a huge subject.
I know.
this is like, wow, you know, like, how deep do you want to dive down the rabbit hole? But But I do understand that there are some human type high tech interventions that are faking alien abductions.
I would believe that too.
For whatever reason.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. But also, during my experience, I found out that there's a lot of other people living here that aren't human on this planet. So
really?
You can actually have an experience with someone off a flying saucer, and he hasn't flown any further than from downtown.
Mm-hmm.
He lives there, you know. So, and then from that experience, I found out there's entities on this planet that are not like physical,
mm-hmm.
but they have the ability to present themselves as physical, and like a holographic image,
mm-hmm.
but they're not real. And you couldn't really touch them. But if you didn't get close enough, you wouldn't know the difference between them being real or not. Because the guys that came to the door, you know, my interrogators, they could have been not real as far as I'm concerned. I never touched them. But
sure.
So there is a huge, you could say, did these other people have alien experiences, or were they some very nasty local people, mm-hmm. local entities that have been interfering with the human, you know, experiences, and at the same time giving genuine ETs a bad name?
Sure.
What
was it that really began to produce the memories for you? I mean, what started to bring it about?
That was dream-based. And I sort of, in this new book, I've concentrated, you know, trying to give a detailed, exhaustive research into the dream world that we all go to at night. And the dreams that remember under normal circumstances are probably the least important of all. It's the ones you don't remember that actually are impacting on you in a subconscious way. So I believe that when you go into the dream state, you leave your body, you go into the astral realm, if you like, and you go to places that are non-physical in our realm. And that could be far distant into the universe, or just within the earth itself, or within realms close to the earth. As in all out of body experiences and people near death experiences, these are all overlaid and are not much different to an alien experience, where you seem to be in a dream state almost. You could call it that, where there's not so much physicality attached to it. You can almost like walk through a wall, as a lot of ETs seem to do in these people's that have had experiences. So you get to the state where the physical hard interface 3D reality ceases to exist. And in the dream state, that is where it's most prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
So I was getting feedback through dreams of the reality of my experiences. The same people that had taken me off planet for 10 days and I had a hard interface interaction with them, we're now coming back to revive those memories. There seems to be some sort of cosmic law that if you leave this planet for any length of time and come back, you cannot remember leaving it. And that includes death. If you're reincarnating back into planet Earth, the cosmic rule seems to be you cannot remember your past life. You might have had 1,000 of them,
right,
but you don't. You can't remember them. That, you know, I don't know why that is, but it just seems to be that it is. But
for those who do, it tends to be traumatic.
Yes. And I can understand why. Okay, if we're here to learn lessons or to live various life experiences, then to hark back to the last couple you've had sort of removes the whole point of having them. Mm-hmm. I can understand that. But I think it goes deeper than that. And once again, rabbit hole, fall down. That's another whole subject you can you can dive down, and we won't get anywhere with what we're trying to discuss here. So I recovered my memory in great detail due to what you could call out-of-body experiences or the dream state, mm-hmm. and brought that back into, they allowed me to bring that memory back in because it was done while I'm still here. Mm-hmm. And that's why it allowed me basically to write this book, because the snatches of memory I had would never have put a story together. And of course, when you add that to what we'll get to eventually, what happened when I got back here, including starting with those guys knocking on my door, you cannot relate those guys from the RIIA to having a comatose 10-day mental breakdown, because they wouldn't have been at my door if that had happened. There wouldn't have been something seriously wrong with the car if I just had a mental blackout.
No.
This is just the start of the reality of those missing 10 days coming back to bite me real time. And it just expanded from that, because by resisting these guys, they made it more adamant that they were going to force me to talk.
Let's put aside the reality of what you began to remember, and let's go back to these shadowy groups clearly having an interest in you, because I mean, obviously there isn't a lot that explains that unless what you experienced during that 10 days is something that would be of value to them. So after you rebuffed their advances that first time around, when they came in and they said, how did your car produce this part, which is totally not based in reality? And you said, I'm not interested, guys, go away. You know, what happened after that?
Yeah, well, I got a bit spooked by that. And at that point, I'd obviously moved out of my friend's place and I was renting an apartment. And I thought, I don't actually have to stay here. I don't know how they found me anyway, but I'll just pack up and go, and I'll get another apartment, you know, other side of the city, not tell anybody except my very closest friends that I was moving and where to. And so I did that. And within a week or two or something of my moving, these same guys were back on the doorstep. So, you know, I had no idea how they traced my movement. And then, so I did that again. I said, well, okay, maybe I gave someone my phone number that I shouldn't have. So this time I'll move again and I won't tell anyone. Just, you know, until I have to, I'll just move. And within, once again, a week or two, they were back on the doorstep. Mm-hmm. So I realized that I couldn't run away. So, you know, this is eventually there was going to be a confrontation with that. And my resistance brought about a whole series of very bizarre business dealings, which I still wasn't thinking that they were so interested that they'd set me up in some way to get hold of me in a manner that they could interrogate me and question me at their own, at their own leisure. Mm-hmm. That never thought to me. And of course, the best way to do that is to get someone involved in a criminal investigation, perhaps, where you tend to lose your rights as a citizen.
Right.
Once the police are involved, there's no way to run away from that. And and through some business dealings I had, I was obviously set up in a way that gave them the opportunity to make me into a criminal, if mm-hmm. you like. Mm-hmm.
And you had no criminal past before this. I mean, it wasn't
I was 40. I was 40 years old. That's at that point in time. I'd lived a squeaky clean life, you know. Mm-hmm. I'd done everything by the books. I always paid my taxes, and like being self-employed, made sure that I was actually, you might say, a model citizen. Mm-hmm. I never rocked the boat.
Right.
Lived just a perfectly normal life. But suddenly, out of the blue, I had these criminal proceedings forced upon me. But at the same time, they were blackmailing me. It went for 2 years. Since they instigated some criminal proceedings.
And said, Alec let's just tell the audience specifically. I mean, this was a bad deal over a car. Like you had an auto dealership. You were selling cars. Someone sold you a car that ended up coming back as stolen or something like that?
Yeah, previously I'd had an automobile dealership. As I said, being interested in motorsport,
yes.
The spin-off was that, oh, well, do what you love. You know, like I was sail-making when I was yachting,
yep.
And now I was dealing and selling and being involved in the car industry while I was racing cars. So that's just logical.
Yeah.
But I had left that business, but I still – I mean, I knew there was, you went to auctions to buy cars and, you get cars at trade prices. There's a lot of places you buy cars at discount right. prices that normal public don't get. And so then you can sell them on at a small profit. And that's how you stay in business.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I knew all about that. I still, even when I retired from the car retail business, I still bought and sold a few cars on the side as a hobby, mm-hmm. as a way, as a small income.
Yep.
That's what I was doing when the shit hit the fan, excuse the expression. So yeah. So I was still going to some auctions and one after these guys had appeared at my door a month or two or so later, I met a guy at an auction house and we just got talking while we were watching cars go through and deciding what to bid on. And he said, oh, I'm importing a few from Japan. Mm-hmm. That was a big rage back in the 90s, 1990s.
It's still pretty big right now.
I'll tell you. Well, Japan has a weird law where if a car's more than 10 years old, you have to pay a huge tax to mm-hmm. register it to put it on the road. So what happens in Japan is after about 10 years, they dump their cars because mm-hmm. it's not economical to keep them. It's cheaper to buy a new one. It's just what you call forced obsolescence. So
right.
it keeps their car industry going. And so countries like New Zealand, which had a big secondhand market and highly priced secondhand cars, because New Zealand's a hard place to export to, you know, the cost is high. Our cars were always dearer than they were in the States or places like that. So you had a ready market in New Zealand where if you could get cars at a discount, wow, you know, it was a bomb went off, you know.
Right.
Like suddenly thousands of cars arrived from Japan. Some privately imported, mostly imported by professional dealers like myself, basically. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was out of the car trade as such as a professional by then. I couldn't be bothered. But this guy said, look, I've got a couple, you know, I've got two or three cars coming in. You might be interested in other sporty sort of cars because he, you know, we were talking. I said, I'm interested in motorsport. I race cars. And he said, well, look, I've got a couple of sports cars coming from Japan. I've got them at a really good price. And he invited me around to have a look at them. They're unregistered. They come in without plates because these cars are deregistered from Japan. Mm-hmm. You have to start all over and re-register them, which I did in this case. But later on, I found out that those cars were not imported from Japan. They'd been stolen from the local market or from the local gene pool, if you like.
Right.
And they were sold to me as imports, but they weren't. They were stolen. And of course, somebody tipped the police off. Surprisingly.
Isn't that convenient? You know? Yeah.
Yes. And, so I got hung up to dry over that. Had it been maybe one car and having a clean, you know, record, as a citizen, I probably could have got away with it. But because it was like three or maybe four cars, I think I brought two or three off them, then another one soon after. They seemed to think that was some sort of a racket, you know, and I should be punished for it.
And what about him? Did anything happen to him or did he just disappear?
No, yeah, well, you know, and suddenly he disappeared off the scene, couldn't be found. You know, he gave me an address. Where I inspected the cars, this was actually a panel beating company. It's not unusual, actually, for them to have cars too. They sell cars, repair cars, sell cars. And he was sort of dealing out of their back door. And mm-hmm. But they said, well, we don't know where he is, where he's gone. Doesn't exist as far as we're concerned. You know, mm-hmm. he's not part of our business. Police didn't want to know, couldn't be bothered. They had me, so just grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and say, you'll do. Mm-hmm. So, Yeah, so So there was proceedings, but of course you just can't convict someone. You have to go to court. I opted for a jury trial because I thought, come on, I'm going to have a lot of people stand up for me and give evidence that I'm a trustworthy citizen, that I don't deal in crooked cars, and I've been in business, you know, half my life. But so there was a long delay between the proceedings going to court and the actual police being involved. And so then I had these guys or guys like them suddenly appear on my door saying that all of these criminal proceedings will disappear in a flash if you just come with us and basically do a debrief.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, by that time, this extraterrestrial side of things had gone a lot deeper, and I was being involved in some stuff which, shall we say, was starting to involve some very bad private agencies on planet Earth that were doing some nefarious things, that we were, between the ET group and myself, going to try and negate.
Okay.
With ET technology, I was going to try and help them clean up this place, basically. That's a rabbit hole we can go down at a later date.
Okay, I'll save it.
What I'm saying is now I was even less inclined to do a debrief with what was almost a military establishment. So I was trying to protect myself and my ET friendships. So it got to be a very delicate situation where basically I just had to wear what they were going to chuck at me.
And what were you looking at?
The thing is that, as I said, for 2 years they tried to blackmail me into cooperating with them. When I resisted, and finally the judge, who was presiding over all these, you have to go to court like every 3 or 4 months while these proceedings are taking place. And the police just said, oh, we're not ready yet to prosecute. We haven't got our ducks in a row. And you can get away with that for a reasonable amount of time. But in the end, the judge said to them, if you don't prosecute, I'm going to dismiss this case.
Mm-hmm.
So that forced their hand.
Let me ask you this, Alec. Do you think that the RIAA and the DSIR, do you think that they were actually in contact with the local police? Was there any sort of official connections that were going on?
Well, you're never privy to these things, are you?
Of course. No.
I have no idea what's going on out the back door.
Yeah.
Were the police kosher? I mean, you can't actually blame the police. If they'd been given a set of statistics, these cars are stolen, he's got them.
Mm-hmm.
Then they just did their thing, but the real crux of it is that these guys were on my doorstep every second week, saying this will go away.
Right.
So you knew it wasn't kosher at a level above the police, at least.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to condemn our police force for something that they didn't know the deeper side of it.
No, I can understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
did
these guys ever like give you anything official, like just like a business card, say, hey, call me if you change your mind? Or did they ever like introduce a location where you could go to, or was it all they just only came to your house and they just wanted to keep it as surface level as possible?
Yep. Well, like these guys, very rare, like late and later in interrogations, no names,
right?
No way to trace who these people are.
Yeah.
No, they never give you a business card. They never give you a phone number.
Yeah.
It's right at your doorstep. And if you agreed to go, well, you'd go and you wouldn't even know where you're going. They wouldn't tell you. You
probably get
in your car.
Black bag.
Yep. Yeah. Whatever. And where you go, heaven knows. But but the deeper I got into the subject, the more and more I realized that's the way they operate. So I knew there would never be a
paper trail.
Well, Yeah, and there'd never be any sunlight on any of the stuff. Yeah. It would always be on the dark side. And you just get to accept that. I mean, even eventually, of course, I had to go to jail because that's what this was all about. Mm-hmm. Once they get you to jail, well, interrogation, here we come, you know, 101. And you don't have rights as a jailed citizen. You've lost them, basically. You're a criminal, so therefore you lose all your basically naysay.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You accept what comes. And I knew what was going to come. I knew that.
Did they put you in like a I don't know what the penal system is like in New Zealand, but we have like county jails, city jails, we have state prisons, we have federal prisons. What type of a facility was it that they sentenced you to?
Well, I think it was shock treatment. You could tell what would they want to do. They'd want to make this the worst experience I've ever had.
Of course.
They'd want me to say, shit, I want out of here. I mean, I was unfortunate or not. I mean, this might have been planned also, that I was sentenced to go to jail in the middle of our winter, right at the coldest time of the year. And they sent me to the oldest, most draconian prison we still had in New Zealand. And this was Mount Eden Prison back in the 1990s. It was a stone castle, literally, with iron bars. And they gave you denim jeans, denim shirt, and a denim jacket. And I mean, I was 40 years old at the stage. I wasn't in the prime of my youth. And they give you one woolen blanket. And I tell you what, when it gets down to close to zero at night, and you've got iron bars for a prison window, no glass, no air conditioning,
you're
in a stone building.
Really?
It got down to zero, and I was bloody freezing, you know, like I was shivering. I was holding myself as tight as I could with this limited gear I had on, and I was not comfortable, I can assure you. And they made me sit that out for several days before I went through indoctrination, you know, and you go through the official procedure of being, taken on board. And then they sent me out of Auckland to a prison farm because I was actually being 40 years of age, a white collar crime, I was low risk. So sure. I was never going to be in a state penitentiary type maximum security. I was always going to be, he won't run away, will he? Because what's he got to gain from that, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think that 2 or 3 days in Mount Eden prison was a soften you up bit, like that's frightened the shit out of him.
Yeah.
And put him in a very uncomfortable position. Because I thought that was like so primitive. I went back to 18th century prison farm, basically, you can say. So, yeah. So, but after that, it got better in a way, and they sent me down country to what you call a prison farm at low security, where you even went out and worked in the forest and that, you know, and you could have run away if you wanted to. And there was no sort of, you went for a walk, you could go exercise in the paddock, and there was nothing between you and the state highway down the road. If you wanted to go hitchhike your way out of there, you could have. But of course, you know, there's nothing to be gained from that.
They're going
to
catch you.
Yeah. I mean, I had nowhere to go. You know? And besides, it already proven that where I was, they turned up on my doorstep. They could somehow track me.
Did they ever try to come speak to you once you actually went to your final destination?
Yes. Well, that was the whole point of it, I think. Mm-hmm. So yes. Yeah, so this is about a month into my prison term, I think. This was about September. This was 1993, by the way. So you're looking at my experience in 1989. And then they set me up in 1990, 91. And then by 1993, they finally sent me to prison so they could interrogate me. So now we're into coming out of winter into spring 1993, which is September in the Southern Hemisphere. So that's where I was at. My original sentence was 12 months. And I found out there was a reason for that too. I mean, for nonviolent crimes, you usually only serve half of your sentence. So even though if it was a 12-month sentence, I was going to be there for 6 months. But if they'd sentenced me for 9 months or 8 months or 6 months from the court, it would not have been on the criminal archives. It's interesting that after it's 12 months or more, you can't, it stays permanently on your record. So this impacts on your travel at a later date. You can't get into certain countries. Like, for instance, I was told by the US Embassy, don't even attempt to get into America. I would never be allowed to get into America.
Wow.
Simply because of 12 months conviction.
All you got to do is just come through the southern border now, Alec.
Yeah. Well,
they don't care anymore.
You don't know how much I'm laughing about that. You know, here, if I tried to get into America from LA or wherever, San Francisco, yep, where we have direct flights from New Zealand, they wouldn't let me in. But if I could go down to Mexico and walk in, obviously. So, yep, you know, yep, like, well, so this is to keep the good guys out.
Yep.
This is simply to keep the good guys out, not the bad guys. I mean, everything's upside down in this world, as you well know. Mm-hmm. You're really into American politics, so you must, yep, understand it's just almost a joke. The rest of the world's looking on and saying, this is a joke. You know,
I was wondering what the other countries of the world thought looking at what's happening here in this country right now.
Oh, well, you know, like, we don't know whether to laugh or cry.
Yeah.
You know, it's insane.
Yeah.
It's bordering insanity. I mean, there's no logic to any of it. You just look at it and say, this is utter madness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Extreme madness. It seems to be, you have to say, first glance, this is deliberate.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
No one can do this by accident, and no one can do it in a loving, meaningful way that they really feel sorry for all these Mexicans and other, itinerant, you know, whatever, people coming from, goodness gracious me, from China through,
yes,
Mexico, et cetera, et cetera. I can't believe that, you know, like, so it has to be deliberate.
Absolutely.
And you think, well, this is a self-destruct mechanism working here. I don't know what the next button they're going to press is, you know. Mm-hmm. You should be very concerned, I would think.
We are definitely. Pardon me. All right. So how long were you at the farm before they came to visit you, and what was that like?
Not very long, probably a week or two, maybe three. This is memory of 30 years ago.
Sure.
And to get that timing precise, but it was enough time for me to get comfortable and accustomed to where I was, because initially when you go into these holding cells, basically they sort of put you in with someone else,
mm-hmm,
initially, and then when they get their ducks in a row, then you go to your own cell. So it's you're there solo confinement during the hours of darkness, but you get out to exercise and do work projects and that during the day. But they waited until I was in my own cell complex before they sent for me. And there was this place that I was at had visitor quarters and that, and interview rooms, I guess. So they had a little room. I don't even think it had a window in it. Pretty, mm-hmm, small. Little, it was almost like a prison cell in itself.
Some privacy.
And so I was summoned there one day, made to wait. I had a guard escort me, and he stood inside the room when I was there. And it was a real interrogation room where the table's bolted down, the chairs are bolted down to the floor. You're not going to pick someone up and bang someone over the head with them.
Mm-hmm.
So this was expected to be a hostile confrontation, I think. You know, it wasn't a friendly, it was a genuine debrief, it was going to be a conflicting interview.
And do the prison guards like tell you, hey, you have a visitor, and it's, you know, it's your lawyer, it's some people you're going to want to talk to, you got family. I mean, did they have any record of who these guys were, or were they able to just, you know, say, hey, I know the warden, I just need to talk to this guy?
Yeah, well, I mean, government departments within government departments are just sort of nods as good as a wink, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Just to walk in.
Yeah.
they don't want to have as you say, a paper trail, there won't be one. Or if there is one, you and I are never going to see it.
No, of course.
No, you could never. You could never nail them that way. But you're right. If I had a visitor, I would be informed. Like if someone was coming from my family or whatever, you would know about it. But there'd be proper visiting hours. These never happened during visiting hours, of course.
Oh, so this was outside of normal protocol.
Yes. Yes, okay. This was. I was called for a debrief, basically. I knew eventually I'd been sort of kind of waiting for it, knowing that something like this would happen. And to be honest, I didn't think I'd ever walk out of there. I thought, once I go in, I'm not coming out. And however they staged that, would it be a knife fight with someone? I mean, it was so easy to get on the wrong side of the very nasty people when you're inside a state prison.
You know, I imagine. Like
nobody, most of the people there are genuine. I mean, genuine criminals, you could say. I mean, maybe not the very worst of the worst, but I could see the dynamics of it, the political dynamics of it, and how easy it is to say the wrong thing to the wrong person, and the next minute you've got a guy flashing a knife at you.
Oh yeah,
past your door.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what I had going on there was some guys that seemed to be there to rack me up would walk past and lock my door because you'd lock it from the outside. It's a prison. But anybody could do that. Any of the other inmates could walk past, flick my door shut, and put the bolt across, and I couldn't get out.
That's kind of crazy.
So, yeah, so I had this sort of aggro going on, and I knew there was someone who was trying to – maybe they were trying to put fear into me. So they were – once again, it's a softening up process.
Yes.
Make me want to get out of there. Make me fear for my life. But they didn't have to do that. I already knew that probably I was in serious stock, serious danger here. And if things had gone wrong or they'd wanted to get rid of me, so easy to have a death.
Absolutely,
have a knife fight and I'm dead and bled to death, you know.
Yeah, just remove you from the equation. So when... So who was it that came to do this debrief? And was it the same agents that had come originally, or was it a whole new crew?
Yes. Well, to start off with, I had British guys initially. I'm guessing MI6 because you will be aware there's an MI5 and an MI6. MI5 is local,
basically
UK, MI6. Yeah. So like your CIA isn't supposed to operate. Yep. Inside of America.
They don't worry about that.
But all I can say is some alphabet agency. I would not. They never identify. They didn't say, "Oh, I'm Jeff Brown from the CIA or MI6." Of course not. You sit here and I'll ask the questions, and you'll answer them. And the threat is if you don't, something bad's going to happen to you. Basically, they need to give you an incentive.
Did they know anything more at this time? Like, I mean, had they come to learn any information that perhaps they didn't make you aware of before? Or was it simply, you know, it's time for you to talk about this circuit board?
Yeah, they never volunteer anything.
Okay.
It's always up to you. It's always up to you to spill the beans. You've got to talk.
Yeah, you know why we're here. Tell us the story.
Yeah. And this isn't going to go away. And they already, as the inference was that, you know, like something nasty could happen to you here very easily. So, you know, the threat is there. They don't have to put a gun to your face. I mean, the threat is that we can kill you. We can get rid of you so easy now. So you better talk. And that's basically, but they don't ever volunteer anything.
No.
They just ask relentless amounts of questions of which it's difficult not to answer sometimes because sometimes they'll tell you a deliberate lie to get you to leap in. You know, say, oh, that's not true. But so then now they've got a lead in. So the best thing to do is not answer any of the questions. And I think I put up with that for several days with the British operation.
So was this, are you saying that they kept you in this interrogation room and like would leave and come back, or they would try for several hours, take you back to your room. Next day, they'd come back in and try. I mean, how what was the procedure?
Yep. Yep. Sleep deprivation, though, was part of this deal.
Okay.
So they would, I think, you know, criminal law, they had to, you know, like there's a prisoner in there and the guards would say, hang on, you know, you need some sleep. So I think they had to work to some sort of law and order in a way, but they basically kept me in there 12 to 15 hours a day, I think. Mm-hmm. So I was allowed out for a small amount of exercise. And I think I might have got 6 hours sleep, maybe less, during the course of the day. Mm-hmm. And then it was back into interrogation again and again and again. So they were trying to wear you down.
And what were they asking you?
Basically, it's almost impossible to put it in a format that makes any sense. Like, start off with, they say, well, we know who you are and we know where you've been and what you've done. And then they say, and now you need to expand on this or you need to expand on that. It's a repetitive over and over and over scenario, which kind of wears you down in a way. Like, they kept talking at you. I don't even know how they could do it. Yeah, they just kept asking you, like, they'd ask you your name. They'd ask you your birth date and all this sort of thing. And then they'd try and get you to expand on that. Where mm-hmm. did you go to school? You know, and they'd try and lead you into different formats of your life to get you to, and then they'd throw in, like I say, the misinformation mm-hmm. to say, we know you did this and we know you did that, which you didn't do at all, to try and, you're trying to refute it. But once again, the best is to say nothing. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. They had more stamina than I do. I don't know how they could go on prompting me all day with these questions, but they were experts at it. I mean, they did alter. I mean, there was more than one guy coming mm-hmm. to question me. They would probably be 2 or 3 hours at a time. Mm-hmm. And then they'd have another guy come in, and it would just be the same relentless questions over and over and over and over again. But of course, they got more and more bizarre. Their lies became more exaggerated, or the, you know, the mistruths they were trying to get you to answer to became more dramatic.
How so?
So anyway, so I endured 2 or 3 days of, look, I actually lost count. Was it 2 days or 3 days? I don't know. But in the end, I had acquired an ability to actually get inside someone's head. Mm-hmm. I can't exactly describe how you do it, but you can actually start to read their mind. Mm-hmm. And from that, you can access their own personal, what can you call it? Dislikes or fears. Mm-hmm. And from that, you can tease out of them what they're most afraid of. And the interesting thing was then I could superimpose on them. This was going on the whole time we were being questioned. I was sort of like working at a, because I wasn't answering. So I didn't have to worry about what question was being asked. This is why half the time I never heard what they asked. I was actually trying to get into their mind, into but behind the scenes of what they were thinking and where their motives were coming from, and trying to access their thought patterns and their fears and desires. And I was then trying to induce in them what they feared the most, to make it me appear to be what they feared the most. Mm. And I actually had one guy had to excuse himself in the middle of interrogation. I think he had almost a mental blackout. Mm. So I knew that my psychology, my way of interrogating them, if you like, or getting back at them, was actually making more inroads into their questioning than they were on me. So they knew, I think, after 2 or 3 days that this was not going to work. And they didn't want to write me off. They didn't want to leave it unsaid. So that's when they sent in what I call the heavy hitter.
And was, what made that person the heavy hitter?
Yeah, but what made he was extraordinary in every way, shape, and form. I think they realized that my mental capacity had been hyped up in some way from the ET interactions, and they were dealing with someone that was slightly above normal human intellect.
Mm-hmm.
So they had run out of options. So their choice, I didn't realize that they had that ability. They sent someone in that wasn't entirely human either.
Okay. So, so a super soldier of sorts?
Well, who knows?
Super spook?
I don't. Super spook. Well, who? I mean, we don't know all the people that work for these alphabet agencies.
Of course not.
We get to see, well, I don't know, most people never get to see any of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd already met by that stage more than most people would ever get to see. I mean, it's bad enough that the RIAA guys, I mean, who's ever heard of the Royal Institute of International Affairs? I mean, even in the UFO groups,
mm-hmm.
I think maybe only one person in a million, and I happened to be talking to him at the time, and he said, oh, I know who they are.
Yeah.
And that was my editor, Duncan Rhodes at Nexus. He knows everything. and he's the one that alerted me when I said, look, I don't know what this institute is. He said, I know exactly who they are. So I was lucky I was speaking to the one person that could sort of open that door for me and realize that hardly anybody gets visits from these guys.
Yeah, so, I mean, I would imagine it has to be a very special circumstance. So, yep. and regard to the caliber of agents and the varieties of agents, you know, I mean, I know from my own research here in America, the CIA, I mean, they had a super soldier program. I mean, they had a program specifically designed to teach agents how to remote view, how to be able to read people's minds, how to use telekinesis. I mean, all of the big dogs in terms of like the psychic world. I mean, they've actually worked with it, and they've worked on technologies to also be able to enhance that for different people as well. You know, I mean, up to and including being able to read somebody's mind by putting electrodes on their heads.
Yep.
Yeah, so well, I would imagine New Zealand would be no different. I mean, Western nations, I mean, there's a place in Australia called Pine Gap, which is basically just a CIA base on Australian soil. So, I mean, I would imagine that New Zealand's got to have relationships like that, too.
Yes, well, there are. I mean, we've got so far to go in this story that the projects that I was on was to deal with a couple of American spy bases in the southern half of the North Island and the northern half of the South Island.
Mm-hmm.
These are part of the Five Eyes agreements, so, you know, like the Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK.
Mm-hmm.
They have a group spy base, and two of the stations are in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And they do more than just spy on emails. You know, there's a lot going on with electromagnetic energy, and I think some dimensional experiments, and I think Pine Gap's part of that group as well. There's a sort of triangulation between Pine Gap, New Zealand, our two bases, and it sort of fits when you put that bit together. Yes. So yeah, we have the equivalent of a Pine Gap on a smaller scale, two of them in New Zealand, and they were the targets that I was going to be trying to interfere with at a later date. And that is, you know, part of the, even when I was talking to my editor, like years later, I hadn't started that project yet. I didn't have the resources, the finances, and the ability or the understanding of the project I'd been given. I needed to talk to more people and get more information and have more help. So I couldn't even talk to people like my editor about what projects I had in the back of my mind. So there was a lot going on here, apart from my resisting the CIA or MI6. I mean, I wasn't even talking to my best friends or my most trusted, you know, confidants. I mean, what I had to do at a later date was so, to me, so important and so delicate that you couldn't trust any one. I didn't know who was listening in to any conversations I had, phone, email, or just talking to someone, you know, in your house.
Well,
who's listening?
I would imagine that there's, I mean, if you're talking about like what I think you're talking about, I mean, it would also be putting your life at risk. I mean, and certainly, you know, your freedom in a whole other respect. I mean, you know, like Chuck Schumer is famous for warning Donald Trump that the intelligence communities here in the United States have six ways from Sunday to destroy your life if they want to. And I think we've seen that all on display here for the last, you know, 7 years or so. And if they're willing to do that sort of thing to Donald Trump, I mean, you know, obviously they've been willing to assassinate political figures here in the past. I mean, you're just a guy, Alec. I mean, they could easily, you know, make that decision to just make you disappear.
Well, that's what I was expecting. And that's why I said when I did finally get locked up, I thought, well, that's it. You're not going to come out of it. Yeah. Because I was adamant in my own mind that I wasn't going to tell them anything they wanted to know. So I knew that, well, probably the end result of that would be termination. Mm-hmm. And I think the only reason I am still alive is because of what I did know, and because they're still always hopeful that they're going to find out what they need to know one way or another, or their technology will improve and they will be able to get in and read my mind or in some way manipulate me to cooperate. And I'm still expecting that at some stage, some more threats to come. It's never over until I'm dead.
And I would imagine.
I fully accept that.
Yeah.
I fully accept that. And the only reason I'm running around here now is because they think I'm more useful to them alive. Like, you don't burn the only encyclopedia you've got. There's something I know that is so delicate and important that even I don't probably understand its significance at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly know that what I was doing with their spy bases would have upset them. And in this new edition of this book, I was always too scared to talk about it until I'd done it, of course. But some of the people that helped me have died of natural causes since then. So
really,
and I'm, yeah. So I'm talking about the main help here was a guy called Bruce Cathy, and he's very famous for his harmonic maths and other aspects of research into the UFO, you know, grid patterns and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been a wanted, hunted man himself. And I knew he was always being watched. And when we met or when we had discussions, we were always careful about how we dealt with it and how we expressed ourselves and what we said. And some of it was whispered stuff, basically, because he was handing me important information. I was giving it back to him. And we sort of knew that someone somewhere would be interested in watching. So that's something I've had to deal with. And you can't talk about that very well because you're dealing with some criminal institutions, which
sure.
When they feel the need to stop this, they will step in and that's the end of it. So yeah, so it had to be very diplomatic. So that's why this is the whole story's been 30 years in the telling, because I've been doing stuff from year to year to year that I didn't want to share with the open world. So, and at the same time, but I wanted to get the story out to the public. Initially, the ET contact, because as I explained before, when I went to these ET groups in Auckland, and so people were so negative about the horrible experiences they've had of being bodies being invaded and probed and all sorts of nasty sort of activities that they had to put up with, which I had none of. I wanted to put out to the world that, hey, there's another side of the ET experience, which is very friendly and cooperative, and they're concerned about us as much as we might be concerned about them. So that's why when I wrote the original first edition, it was just a very basic, this is what happened in the 10 days away.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to keep the the proceedings after that down to a minimum because I knew it hadn't ended yet. Mm-hmm. And there was still stuff going on in the background I couldn't talk about. So the story was, in that stage, very much screened down to a friendly, easy to understand stuff. But now that I've done most of the stuff I intended to do and some of the people that might have been harmed if I'd talked earlier on, I've now passed on anyway. I can't do so much harm now. So the third edition is full on. Let's tell it like it is so that people get an idea. This is a hostile government working here, and they are working against ET stuff mm-hmm. as much as they're working against our freedom. So
we've only got about 20 minutes left here. And I want to make sure I'd like to kind of just wrap up what happened in terms of the government's actions coming after you. And I do want to talk a little bit about what actually you remember from those 10 days. So how much longer did this interrogation attempt go on? Was this like, you know, for a limited period of time, or was it ongoing throughout the 12 months you were in prison?
Well, as I said, we only spent 6 months in prison in the end because of, yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, no, they gave it. I mean, after this, the MI6 guys had left and they brought in this heavy hitter, which I called House because he was as big as a house. He had to duck.
The super
spook. He had to duck to get down. Yeah, we've got 6'6" door jams in New Zealand. So not many people have to duck to get under a door jam, but he did. And he filled the whole door frame at the same time. So he was huge. He was a massive physical entity, indescribable. But I mean, one word I tried to use one word to describe him, that would be albino, because he was so fair,
very pale.
His skin was snow white. His hair was like silver almost. The hairs on his arms were silver, and he had these translucent blue eyes and this massive size of him. I mean, and the first thing he did when he walked in the door was he tried to suck everything out of my head.
Mm-hmm.
Having spent the last few days with the MI6 guys trying to suck stuff out of their head, I knew straight away he was attacking my thought patterns. Mm-hmm. He wanted to debrief me in a moment. He wanted to empty my head. Unfortunately, where I'd been for 10 days with extraterrestrial entities, they had taught me how to screen your – because they use telepathy – for communication, it's very easy to read everyone in the room.
Sure.
If you wanted to, like you have a conversation with an extraterrestrial, and you can, in a shadow echo, you can hear everyone's thoughts around you from your conversation with him. So I was taught how to screen that out. So you can have a one-on-one conversation with extraterrestrial in a telepathic manner, but not share it with everyone else in the room. Sure. So immediately, fortunately for me, well, I think they probably knew what was going to happen. So they taught me these little tricks that you can shut your mind down and you can't have it plucked dry from externally. So he tried to read my mind. I blanked him out straight away, and immediately he acknowledged that.
Like verbally or mentally?
Well, just in the nod of the head. Oh yeah, okay. Like, you know, when you've aced a serve in tennis or something, you know, and the other guy says, "Yeah, okay." I never even saw that.
Yep.
The thing is, wow, that was clever. That was good. I didn't expect that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sort of thing I got from him, and immediately that set us on a level playing field. I think
mm-hmm.
suddenly he realized this isn't going to be a walk and snap. You know. Get the information, break his neck and walk out, you know. Suddenly you realize, I'm going to have to play chess here, and I'm going to have to trick this guy into telling me stuff, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the feeling I got from him. So we now had a totally different sort of a debrief, totally different interrogation. And I realized that I wasn't talking to a normal person either. This guy was something very special, and I didn't quite know how to take him. The first thing is you think, whoa, you know, what have we got here? And I sort of backed right off. I didn't want to say or do anything. But so this was a sort of get to know you process. And in the end, I mean, we had a to and fro going because he was starting to share stuff that I never expected to get.
Such as,
I'm basically not from here.
Really?
Where he was telling me. Yeah. Like, to me, you're a fungus. That's the first thing he said. all humans are just a fungus, you know. Right? And I looked that up later on. He's actually not far off being true. We're more fungus than anything else. We're about 90% fungus, and well, what else, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, in a roundabout, it's a very intelligent way to give someone an insult, you know. he knew more about me than I did. So in the end, we started sharing a bit. I had to. I mean, I'm sorry. I can't rush into this for your 20 minutes.
No, it's okay.
Because this is so important. People have to realize.
It's okay. Don't worry about rushing. If you're willing to come back, we can do another show.
Yeah, well, we can see we're going to have to because we haven't even started. We haven't started yet. We're talking 30 years of my life. So,
yes.
And some of it's like, people are just not going to believe this.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to do here is give you such a background that when I say, so I'm going to start saying some pretty startling stuff soon.
Right.
That people are going to say, oh, what? You know, but if you put the package I've just presented to you, that this is going on for 30 years and I've been locked up and given a rough time over this, that, this is not just, oh, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody really, really, really wants to know what's going on in my head and what I learned and what I'm doing here now.
Mm-hmm.
And the main reason I'm still alive, I think, because somehow or other, they want to extract some bit of information that they haven't heard before. And this guy, House, which I don't know what his name was, obviously don't know who he worked for, although I was given a chance to become a member of a business group that he was part of anyway. Executive Outcomes. If anybody wants to Google that at some stage, Executive Outcomes is a paramilitary operation that once again was in its prime in 1993, and went out of business soon after my interrogations, believe it or not, and have since actually reformatted themselves. I don't know whether they call themselves Executive Outcomes anymore. But anyway, they're a group that sold themselves out to governments to set, if you've got a terrorist organization within a government or within a country, and you want them out, you send these guys in.
They look like private contractors of some sort.
They are. This is what I learned about the UFO phenomenon. It's never done by government agencies. It's always done by some alphabet agency which doesn't have a boss to report to in anybody's government.
Mm-hmm.
And House was a prime example. Here we have, now I'm going up the ladder, like I'm gone from MI6. We've gone from the police to, you know, to DSIR to MI6. Now we've gone three or four stages above all those levels. So now I'm talking way above CIA, way above NSA levels. We're now talking secret agencies that don't have a name and that work for institutions like Executive Outcomes that can be disavowed, can be disbanded,
right,
can
right.
be opened out, closed down anytime. Now,
plausible House deniability.
House used that base lever as his leap into a world that I might understand. So in other words, you come and work for me at Executive Outcomes. But meanwhile, of course, House wasn't working. He might be a consultant, but in actual fact, he was working at levels above that again
mm-hmm.
in these secret secret alphabet agencies. So immediately I knew I was dealing here with someone above my normal levels, a normal pay grade of anybody. That alone, once again, sort of hammered home the fact that, there's something very important. I must know something really important. I don't think anybody would ever have seen a guy like House and been questioned by him before. So I'm up a couple of levels above CIA for sure. And this guy had technology with him. When he walked into the room, he had a carbon fiber briefcase. Now, we're going back to the early 90s. Carbon fiber wasn't a common stuff. Mm-hmm. You didn't see it everywhere. You know, now it's common as muck.
Yeah.
But I knew from my days of motorsport and yachting that carbon fiber had just started to come on the market. It was a lightweight, strong stuff, but it was non-magnetic. So if you wanted something very strong and couldn't be damaged in any way easily, but would not interfere with a magnetic signal or you know, communication device or mm-hmm. some high technology, that this would be the ideal compartment to put it in.
Right.
I never saw inside that briefcase. Whenever he opened it in my presence, I only ever saw the back of it, obviously. But there were things that he was doing in there. He'd put his hands in and things would start to happen in the room. Or initially, he produced from the briefcase a little like a dice.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know it at the time, but it was some extraterrestrial artifact. And he said to me, I hope that you would recognize this and you can do something with it because we've had a problem getting it to work. And I didn't voluntarily switch anything on, but as soon as I touched that device, it turned itself on.
And what happened? What do you mean it turned itself on?
Well, it started to become a projector of some sort.
Okay.
And it started, it levitated itself and started to spin.
Okay.
And being a dice, but it became sort of multi-shaped, functional. And then it started to scatter images around the room,
mm-hmm.
like a holographic letter writing. And House immediately said, oh my God, what's the right phrase for it? Can't quite think out. It's gone out of my mind now. Atomic sort of number sort of sequences for different elements.
Okay.
So and he said, this is a scale of atomic elements slightly above what we normally use. And he said, I've heard about this. And he was panicking. He was, first thing he said, quick, write that down, as if to say one of his underlings or something was in the room. He was in the room on his own. He suddenly realized he was giving instructions to nobody. He was, I think it took him by surprise that, A, that this device started to work and that it was giving him information that he desperately wanted mm-hmm. and he didn't have the facilities to record it. So immediately that put us on a level play field because he realized then that he was dealing with something unusual. And I realized that, hey, he had extraterrestrial artifacts in that suitcase or something in that suitcase. How did he get? And that little article recognized me from where I'd been for those missing 10 days. The imprint was that from my extraterrestrial hosts that I was at some stage in my past a member of their family lineage. So, I mean, who knows where we've reincarnated over the course of a history and a lifetime of human beings. A lot of us could have been born on other planets and reincarnated on Earth or been born on Earth and gone to other planets, etc. So I got from that instance that this thing recognized who I was in either another lifetime or who I had just been in my missing 10 days.
Hmm.
And it switched on as if I had the okay to drive this thing. So, and you know, from research I've done since that day, of course, it's not uncommon for people with extraterrestrial experiences to be able to evidently motivate or turn on some high-tech devices. So,
you know, I mean, specifically with regards to vehicles that have been recovered, I've heard that there is a biological operating component, that these vehicles require a being to actually interface with it, so that the propulsion system is actually being driven by someone's mind, or perhaps it's turned on by the electromagnetic energy of the person or the being that's actually touching it. So I wonder, you know, I mean, I would imagine as a concept that could be transposed onto any such object.
That's my understanding of it too. So if you expand that slightly, mm-hmm. then what I would understand is their interest in me, especially after that instance, was that, hey, hang on, if we've got some extraterrestrial craft somewhere that we can't get to work, maybe a guy like this can make it work.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they still would have had to get me there, if you know what I mean, and wherever that craft might be, out of the country, whatever. So I but once again, if you don't do it willingly, you can shut that down. I shut that down. In fact, I sent that off.
Mm-hmm.
I sent that spinning dice out through the door. Or not out through the door, out through the wall.
It just flew off?
After I realized what was happening and House would have been able to get information from this, and I thought, hang on, is this compromising me or my friends, my extraterrestrial friend? Is this going to be a negative outcome? I just flicked it. Like, I did that, and it went. It went back to source, wherever that was. But it went straight through that wall.
So what was his reaction to that?
Yeah, well, he wasn't very pleased about that. I didn't even know where it would have gone, but he said, you've sent it back to source, whatever that means. I mean, that was a new phrase for me. So he had it imprisoned, if you like, in some way. But it wouldn't be active until it got close to someone that could activate it. And then when it did, I didn't want him to use it. Mm-hmm. So immediately, though, they still need my cooperation. If I can make something even bigger than that little dice operate, wherever that thing might be, they would still need my physical consent.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think this is an overriding sort of universal law and with the ET interaction with humans is that on a legitimate level, you can't have it if you don't want it. You can send them away. You can say, no, I don't want to talk to you, and they won't. If they're real and legit, they'll back off. But if you encourage it, like with CE5, you go out in the field and you stargaze and you will them to come to you, they will. You can get ET interactions. But if you don't want them to, you can also send them away. And I think what I'm understanding here is if I don't want a device to work, I can make sure it doesn't, even if I'm in its presence. So there's a universal law of consent here, which even House was operating under, I think. He acknowledged that I didn't want to cooperate, so he was going to have to earn my respect. And that's what the next few days in his presence was all about. And he started to show me then more technology, which I don't know how we're going for time, but I can maybe just touch on.
Well, yeah, go ahead and just, yeah, touch on it briefly. And then I've got some donations that I need to read from the audience, and then we'll wrap it up and we'll adjourn for a later date.
Okay. So, what he was trying to say is, I understand your feelings. I understand that some wrongs have been done here. He was obviously involved in extraterrestrial craft recovery, ET crash craft recovery.
Mm-hmm.
He had that ability, and he had that knowledge. And within his machine, within that carbon fiber case, he reached in and he sent us on a trip. He actually projected me back in time somehow to one of these crashed ET craft. And it was a craft relating to the experience that I had with the people for I'd been 10 days with. Mm-hmm. They had had a craft on Earth that had been shot down and crashed in the Kalahari Desert in South Africa. And he took me to that crash site to get, I think, my reactions to it and to see what the reaction of the craft would be to, for my presence. He did a bit of grilling. He asked me about what I thought about it, what, where stuff could be. Did Jackson stuff out? Was there crash stuff here buried in the ground still? All that stuff. But it was like he took me back, must have been 10 years into the past. This craft had crashed in 1982, I believe, and this was 1983 that we're having this conversation. He took me 11 years back into the past, and I swear, as I stood there in the Kalahari Desert looking at this craft, that it wasn't so much a holographic prediction as I could have touched it and it was real. But I remember I picked up some dirt because I said, this stuff will compost in a minute. That craft will has a decomposing aspect to it. It's a a bio object, and it will just compost away to nothing. That's why you don't get real ET craft brought into captivity very often. They can destroy themselves on site. But anyway, I actually picked up some ground. I swear the sand ran through my fingers while I was standing in the Kalahari Desert. How the hell that device in his suitcase, briefcase, could have sent me back 11 years in time so that I could touch the ground that I was standing on, I do not know. So that was my, you know, that's when I realized this technology that he had was light years ahead of anything that we are dealing with.
Certainly.
And I thought, who the hell is this guy that he has technology like this? But of course, since then, and this is 1993, of course, I've had 30 years to research. I think technology on Earth in these higher realms of alphabet agencies might actually include stuff like that, time travel.
Absolutely.
Or holographic projections of time travel. Might well be in their gambit, might well be in their reality. And we'll never see it out here in the open world. But I was privy to some stuff that I don't know anybody has ever seen before. They were desperate to get my cooperation in any way or shape or form. So he was, I was getting my money's worth out of house because I was seeing stuff without virtually doing anything, without saying very much at all. I was getting to see the other side of his world.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I call my book, the newest version of this book, The Secret World, because there is a world out there that most people will never see.
Yes.
And I've been privy to it. And I'm one of the few people still alive that can tell you about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm deadly serious about it. And I knew while I'm still alive, I have to get some of this documented and print and imprint in some way, even though I can't photograph it for you and give you the real feel for it, I have to explain it in a way, and I've tried to in that book, in this new book, to take you on those journeys with me. And that's basically the driving force for me still for the next few years is while I still can and while they're letting me tell you everything I can about House and his world.
Well, I, for one, am looking forward to seeing this new version of the book. And I know that I've seen some schematics and drawings and such that you had included. Was that from a previous version or are these previews from what's going to be coming out in the new book?
There's a little bit of both. There's
okay.
some older stuff, of course, because it's the same story.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an expansion of such. And with computer artwork these days, you can do some amazing pictures without too much of a hassle. You don't need such a commercial artist to be, you know, that costs a fortune. I could never afford to do that. So within the book, I've computed some, I've included some computer imagery, which is not real. It's not the actual scene, but it's as close as I could get in a sort of a semi-realistic format, and as a picture is 1,000 words, so it surely helps presentation.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so Alec, before I go through these these donations from the audience. When do you anticipate that the new version of the book will be available for people to check out?
Well, my editor's working on it right now, I hope. Right this very moment, I hope. Amy wants to do it properly, so maybe within a month or so.
Okay, all right,
I would
cool.
hope that within a month or two, at the max, we should have it. It'll primarily be a electronic version because printing these days is very expensive.
You're right.
We will print on demand, basically. If somebody wants a hard copy, mm-hmm. we'll get it to them. But predominantly, it will be electronic, so it makes it cheaper and quicker.
Okay,
so
all right.
That's what it'll be.
And the original versions of the book are out of print. I mean, I was able to find a couple of copies online, but they were very expensive.
I don't know why. For something that hardly anyone knows about, and I wouldn't have thought up till now anybody really cared. Like, I've been trying to tell the story for 30 years, but I tell you what, we've been blocked in a lot of ways that mm-hmm. you couldn't imagine. I mean, when someone's got something real to say, you know how they can say. I should ask Donald Trump.
Absolutely.
Anybody wants to get the truth out, they've got 1,000 ways to stop it.
It's true.
And have a look at how many people follow me mm-hmm. on Twitter, on X. Nobody knows I exist.
Yes.
And I've been around for years, and I've got, I mean, there are some TV documentaries we've done, and they have had up to 1 million hits.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, we fade away very quickly again, like someone's shadowing us and mm-hmm. Deleting as much as they can, following in our footsteps. So you might expect, you might find from now on some of your stuff disappears. I don't know. I hope not.
It still happens. Anyway. It definitely happens. So let me ask, just for anybody who's skeptical out there. A lot of people, as I said, will monetize an experience like this. I mean, they will really make it their life's work to get it out there. Like, they'll, sell the movie rights, or perhaps, they'll try to get a deal with a publishing house, like Whitley Strieber. Okay. He's one of the most famous, ET contactees out there. He's got a series of books. I mean, the guy's everywhere. And, you look at some of the big people in the extraterrestrial field, and, they're always doing conferences, and, they're front and center. They've got interviews all the time. So why is it that you haven't chosen to go that route too? You've had a regular life.
Yeah, I'm a private guy, and this really, I mean, this has destroyed my life anyway.
Yeah.
But in the background of that, I still try. I've been trying to patch it. It's taken me 30 years to get it back to what it was.
Mm-hmm.
But, I was a businessman. I wasn't unsuccessful. I had a comfortable lifestyle. I had a lot of fun.
Yep.
And this destroyed all that. This absolutely, I mean, it's a joke to say I'm going to sell a book and get my money back. I couldn't write enough books to get my money back. Like, my life, I've lost millions of dollars in my life, basically, because I haven't had a life. So just to tell anyone, you think I'm going to get some money from writing a book, you've got to be joking. We're barely going to break even anyway, which is why we're doing it e-format, because even my publisher knows, shit, will we even recover our costs? Mm-hmm. No. Will I recover hundreds of thousands of hours of work, research, and writing, because I'm not a writer. It mm-hmm. takes me a lot of work to put words on paper.
Yeah.
And that's another reason. I don't want to write a bloody book. That's not my format. So there's no money in this. And I've been trying to be private. So how do you be private and promote yourself?
Right.
It doesn't work.
No, it doesn't.
So, no. So you know what won out. My privacy won out. And I do these interviews only now because I feel I owe my publisher. He's going to put a lot of time and effort into the third edition, that I should talk to a few people like yourself
mm-hmm.
that has a listening base of switched on people, which makes my whole point worthwhile, because I know that they'll get it. Even they might doubt it, but they'll get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I can hope for. So once again, how much money am I getting paid, Zach, for this talk?
Yeah, nothing. Yeah, I can't afford to pay yet.
Exactly. Yeah. So, well, gee, now I can go out and buy another race car. Yeah, so that only comes from what I do besides this. So,
right.
So that should answer all our questions.
All right. Excellent. Well, listen, Alec, I am, like I said, I'm very excited to see the new book. I'm also very excited to have you back on the show. I know that there's so much more to get into. You guys, as Alec said, there have been a couple documentaries. You can find some news articles about him, you know, different things. But this was seriously one of the more interesting sort of contactee experience stories that I had ever heard. But it hasn't really been covered that well. So I really appreciate you coming on the show here tonight. I reached out to him on Twitter. I was like, what are the chances? You know, sometimes you don't know if people are going to reply to you. Like, if you have no idea who I am, or you're like, I don't want to talk to anybody. But you wrote back really quickly, and you've been just a pleasure to work with. Very, very nice guy. And I love race cars. I'm a bit of a tinkerer myself. I love to build things. And I understand the life of a polymath, just doing everything on your own. And I'm also a small business owner. So anyways, we got a lot in common, and it's been a great time talking with you. Let's go through these questions and comments over here. Let's see. Fred Awakening says, this is a joke, but he's our resident comedian. He says, I had a similar experience. I took a 3-hour trip in a Yugo back in the 80s, but it definitely felt like 10 days. Mohab. and this is actually, well, I'll wait till I get to the Jacinda Ardern question before I ask you what Mohab is. Let's see. RIIA is Five Eyes Deep State Intelligence to clean up the mistakes made by subordinates. Future Objective says, for a laugh, can we get Alec's take on Jacinda Ardern? So, Alec, before I get your take on Jacinda Ardern, MOHAP is an acronym. It means Michelle Obama has a penis. and Jacinda Ardern had, there's a famous picture of her walking down the hallway, and she appears to be packing a six gun. What are your comments on Jacinda Ardern? Any thoughts on her? Are you glad she's gone?
Well, if I had a spade, she'd be 6 foot under, put it that way. Yeah. You can't say a lot in this country, you know, because there's a hate this and hate yes. that, and yeah. you're not allowed to say this and not allowed to say that. And if I said, you know, if I had a six gun, it'd be empty and she'd be full of lead. That, you know, that could go down the wrong way.
Yes, but it could. No, it could.
She hasn't done us any favors, and she's bankrupted the country, quite honestly.
She has.
With her policies, apart from everything else. So, you know, she's brought in segregation. She's crippled a lot of businesses. She's, you know, locked us all in our homes, and these are people that are healthy being mm-hmm. locked in their homes while all the sick people roam the street. So, yeah, there's a lot that I could say that I won't. But I think you get the idea.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. I mean, throughout the entire COVID madness, the pandemic, I mean, we were definitely following the plight of the people of New Zealand. I mean, they were very, very aggressive about trying to make sure everybody got the jab. And, you know, one of the reasons that I always thought that they had worked so hard there is because you are an island. I mean, you're an island nation. Your population is much more confined. Obviously, you don't have the same freedoms to speak or to move as we have here in the United States. I mean, and even here, that's being restricted more and more each day. And so I kind of looked at New Zealand as sort of, a test case. You know, I mean, like, it's a controlled environment that they could see just how much they could do to get people to comply. And unfortunately, you know, I mean, they made it sound like virtually the entire island got the jab. But I mean, I assume that's probably not the case.
You got it right, actually. We have been the experiment of choice for a lot of financial institutions as yep. well. We had what we call an FBOS card, which is, you know, access to your bank account with a credit card type format. We were the first company in the world to have it. So they do try out a lot of stuff here. I'm just hoping we're not the first ones with a cashless society because yes. that will really put the cat among the pigeons. But, of course, we've got that to look forward to at some stage, I think. I don't know how we're going to combat it, but we should. New Zealand has been used for experiments in the past. You're right.
Absolutely. All right. Keith O'Higgins says, hey, Fredo, do you know the best part of a Yugo, the rear window defroster? It would keep your hands warm while you're pushing into the wintertime. Keith also says, has Alec ever tried any local native Moa tribe cures like a sweat lodge or microdosing to reconnect with the dreams or to get over any PTSD for missing time? And I don't know about any of that specifically. So any commentary on the local ancient population and perhaps any experiences there?
I did try regressive no therapy at one stage. But unfortunately, that threw up a whole lot of experiences that weren't related to this one, and they were, once again, off-planet, quite possibly. Mm-hmm. So we just sort of, we better not go there. It's just making it more confusing. There's obviously, I've had more life experiences than just this one, off-planet. And so, yeah. But quite honestly, I've not been running away from this, but I can't get away from this because it's part of my life.
Right.
And because I've been working in the background trying to do some projects related to it, there's not a lot I can do to open it up. I mean, because I can't open up to some people. Mm-hmm. I don't want strangers knowing what I'm doing next. So once again, that privacy pitch, you know, that sole operator, is a format I've had to stick with. So no, I haven't gone looking for help, and even in a spiritual sense. Mm-hmm. This whole thing has taken over my life. To be honest, could I get rid of it and put it on a back burner somewhere? I might just think about that and do that and never talk about it again.
Yeah.
So I don't want to bring it more forward than it is.
Okay.
It's been enough of a burden.
I can absolutely understand that. And then Keith, also earlier, I forgot to mention this one, but we did answer this, Keith, and hopefully you heard any beard growth during that missing time, no 5 o'clock shadow times 10. And Alex had said, yes, no, there was. It was as if you had only actually been on that 3 hour trip. You didn't look like you had been gone for 10 days. And then Keith also, oh, no, I'm sorry, this is Fredo. He says, your Rumble chat has been stationary on stream. Just FYI, I thank you. I got that and I fixed it. Then Keith also said, since Kiwis love football, is there an all Black Lives Matter movement there? Do they have Black Lives Matter in New Zealand, or is there some equivalent for the local Maori tribes? Is that who the natives are, the Maoris?
Maoris, yeah.
Maori, sorry.
Yeah. They have their own political movements and political parties, and they're very, what I would say, active. Mm-hmm. They look after themselves. I don't think anyone needs to help them.
Yeah.
They are pretty strong in their own biodiversity of it. But, I mean, we've got this rainbow stuff coming in, and it just confuses everyone about what do you really mean, you know?
Right.
And we've had the segregation with Jacinda, you know, trying to jab from unjabbed, and all of a sudden, you know, hate, you know, if you're unjabbed, you've got to be, everyone hates you and you they want you dead, this sort of format. So we don't need any more of that shit. Mm-hmm. But the Maori groups and political parties are very strong. And they take care of themselves. I don't really need any help from anyone.
So is the Maori population, like, integrated into the larger New Zealand population, like those political groups? Do they participate in, like, the official New Zealand government? Like, because here in America, I'm sure you're aware, the Native American tribes, they're almost like separate sovereign entities within the United States, like the reservations.
No, we pretty much take everything as you see it.
Yeah.
If you want to stand for politics and you're a Maori, then you stand on open ground.
Okay.
They do have their own party, of course, and within that they select their own candidates mm-hmm. to stand. Or so, yeah. Look, I don't want to get into politics because
sure. It's
actually, as you probably know, bullshit anyway.
Yes, I mean.
They all get told what to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, they get into politics with all these wide-eyed ideas, and the next minute they're toeing the line.
Right.
So, you know, somebody's had a little whisper in their ear and say, you do this, mm-hmm. or all your skeletons are going to come out. But also a country like New Zealand, the ruling fraternity, whoever they are, is only going to say, okay, we're going to cut off all your oil supplies mm-hmm. if you don't toe the line with the monetary fund or whatever, you know, WEC, whatever. WEF, sorry. So a small nation like New Zealand that has no huge amount of resources, we can be isolated so very quickly and blackmailed.
Yeah.
So I would imagine every politician that stands up to be counted and wants to do things his way is very quickly reminded that you don't have that option.
Right. Play ball.
That's That's the way with all politicians. You get told what to do.
Yes, very, very true. And then Keith also responded, I guess there's a joke I didn't miss. The football team is called All Blacks. That's the joke. I don't follow football, so I'm not certain, but I'll take your word for it, Keith. And then Fredo says, great interview, guys. Out of respect for the guest and for the good people of New Zealand, I offer you a J-Hap in memory of Jacinda Ardern, Big Mike's brother from another mother. And then Keith says, quick New Zealand trivia question. Do you know why horses run so fast in New Zealand? Because they see what happens to the sheep. I don't know.
I think that's one of those jokes that you got to tell privately.
Yes, I think so. I can kind of infer where that might be going. But let's see. Number one Indiana dad says, interesting subject. Thank you for all you do. Mohap, Mr. O equals Michelle Robinson. And then number one Indiana dad, I saw that you had donated yesterday on Ko-Fi as well when I was at that film premiere. And then Muffingate 69 says, I'm going to rant till you remember me. Muffingate, you will never be forgotten. So quick story. This is from several years ago, but we had a mishap happen on the show. I was live on the air. This is back when I lived in Michigan. And this is a standing desk. So I had it standing up and I was interviewing a friend of mine who was in Russia. And my dogs, when the desk is standing, I have beds for them underneath the desk and they'll sleep in the beds. And normally they're very, very nice, Alec. They never fight or anything like that. And for some reason this night, like I had given them treats before I went on the air because I wanted them to be preoccupied. And I think that one of them finished before the other one, and then the other one got into the face of the other one. And so anyways, they started fighting. It was this loud, like snarling, whirling dervish of fur and nails and teeth. And I was like, oh my God, oh my God. And I couldn't get them to stop. And so finally I got one of them away and I took them off. And my buddy John on screen, he just like, without missing a beat, he was like, wow. He just kept going and answered the question. And it was clipped by one of the viewers of the show. And it's been passed around for years now. And it's known as Muffingate. It's known as Muffingate. So
You better send me a copy of that.
I will. I'll send it to you after the show. And then Keith O'Higgins, thank you again. I appreciate it. We got the joke. Okay. Over on Pilled, Nikki the Greek, thank you very much for the cookie. EO2 Dave, thank you. Thank you to Sean Joe. Thank you to Michelle Ann and Porpoiseful and Sean Joe and Polly for dropping a fleet. Polly9369, thank you so much. Sean Joe, thank you for the can. Patriot 714, question for Alec. How often are the interactions with these extraterrestrial friends? Are you still having ongoing interactions in some sort? And if not, then what was the frequency?
Well, because it was in dream state, they could basically get to me any night that I'm asleep. Mm-hmm. If it's so important that it needs to be done, and it hasn't actually happened over the last several years.
Okay.
But before that, it was reasonably regular because they were giving me updates and I had projects to do and I needed their help because I was floundering. Mm-hmm. That's why I did need to take the confidence of a couple of close friends to try and get me on track. But it was I couldn't give a regular date for it, but it was, you know, like few months.
Yeah, yeah.
Every few months over the initial years, a lot less now.
Okay. All right. And then thank you to Sean Joe, who also dropped a cookie. All right. So we are now at the end of the show. As I said, Alec, I would like to have you back in the future and we can get into a lot more of this in depth. I knew when you were coming on the show that this was a distinct possibility that it might be necessary to do multiple shows. And I'm very excited to do so. At the end, I always like to ask my guests what you would most like for the audience to take away from this conversation tonight.
I think, you know, I hinted at that earlier on, is that a lot of people have had some very negative experiences with what they consider to be ET interactions. And I'd just like people to question, is that actually an ET interaction, or is it some nefarious sort of organization on Earth giving you a blast of some different sort? And also the fact that there are some ET lookalikes that might live on this planet and haven't got the human race as their best friends. So they're always trying to put one over on us. So genuine extraterrestrial interactions, I think, are quite rare, which might be an example of it, why people have taken particular interest with my experience. So I think you need to have a wider, more open understanding that there's more than just, not every ET experience is what it appears to be.
Okay, excellent. Well, again, thank you very much for being here. Fredo says, night all, great show. Thank you, Alec. Fun time, Zach. We'll see you Monday. Hit the thumbs up if you aren't a commie. That's right. If you are not a communist, make sure you hit that thumbs up before we leave the show tonight. And I will be back Monday at 5 p.m. for another episode of Red Pill News Live. Until that time, good luck. God bless. We'll see you then.